We simply know that that's the history behind this particular part of the book. Now, Bill himself, though, was also cunning, baffling, and powerful. Because he said to them, okay, I'm going to compromise with you, but you're going to have to compromise with me. And they said, well, what do you want? He said, I'm tired. He said, I've fought with you and I've argued with you all the way through the book. And he said, frankly, I'm not going to go through this anymore. And he said, if you want me to finish the book, then you give me the authority to do so. And if you don't want to give me the authority, then you finish the book yourself. Well, they didn't want to give him that authority, but they didn't want to finish the book either. So they very reluctantly agreed to do this. Now, what Bill knew that they didn't know is 2 pages later, he's going to put directions right back in the book. And he's going to put you and must right back in the book. And when they took it out of how it works, they ruined some of the continuity of the book. Because prior to this, he's talked about directions, and he's used the words you and must. And then they took them out in how it works in chapter 5. And then 2 pages later, he sticks them right back in. And that ruined some of the continuity of the book. But now that we see what he originally intended, certainly we can see what he had in mind the night he wrote the 12 steps. I think the other thing that is so important for us to recognize is the whole idea of the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters is to sell us on 3 pertinent ideas. A, that we're alcoholic and cannot manage our own lives. And surely by now, as we've read and studied these doctor's opinion in these first 4 chapters, we've been able to reach that conclusion. And we're sold on that idea. B, that probably no human power can relieve our alcoholism. And if we've read and studied the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters, we've probably reached that conclusion also. And that God can and will if he sought. If we've studied the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters, especially the 4th chapter, chapter 4, we agnostics, we've reached the conclusion that God not only can and will, but probably would do that for us. Now, if we've reached those conclusions, then we're through with steps 1 and 2. You know, people come to us today and they say, well, how do you work 1 and 2? From step 3 on, there's a certain pattern in the steps. From step 3 on, he always tells us why we need to work a step, how to work it, and what the results will be. But he doesn't do that on 1 and 2 because they are not working steps. When people come to us and say, how do you work steps 1 and 2? We say, you don't. There's no work involved. They are conclusions of the mind that we draw based upon the doctor's opinion and the first 4 chapters. You see, I've always been powerless over alcohol. I just didn't know that, nor did I really know why until I read the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. There's always been a power greater than I am that can restore me to sanity. I just didn't believe that that power would do that for me. Nor did I even know what the insanity was until I read the doctor's opinion in the first 4 chapters. And now that I've absorbed that information, if I can say to myself, I'm powerless over alcohol, my life is unmanageable, I'm through with 1. If I can say to myself, I've come to believe there's a power greater than I am can restore me to sanity, I'm through with 2. And the very next statement in the book says, being convinced, we're now at step 3. So everything we've done up until this time is to convince ourselves of steps 1 and 2. We're now at step 3. You see, that's why you can hardly start with chapter 5. Hard to start with 5 because you don't have 1 and 2 behind you. And it's difficult to start with 3 without already knowing about 1 and 2. Joe?
Okay, we can also see how Bill, as we read the steps, how Bill developed the 12 steps that night from the original steps of the Oxford group that they were using. What he did, actually, he took the planned program of the Oxford groups which they were using at that time. They had a step called Surrender, and he turned that into, and Bill put these things into words that alcoholics could use. Now, surrender your will to God. Bill turned that into make a decision to turn your will and your life for care of God as you understand. He said it in a better way for alcoholics, more acceptable. He took this step, examine your sins, which is a pretty rough thing on an alcoholic. He turned that into make a searching and fearless moral inventory. He took sharing and confessing, and he put that in to admit to God, yourself, another human being, the exact nature of your wrongs. Steps 6 and 7 were steps he added that night. He said the Oxford group program needed more strength or power than they had at that time. So he added 6 and 7. These are the changing steps. Step 8 and 9 was a one-step process called restitution. And Bill turned that into 8 and 9. He also added another step in step 10, more power, more changing tools into the 12 steps. Step 11 was called guidance, receiving guidance from God. And they felt like they could practice receiving guidance from God. I mean, Bill simply turned that into sought through prayer and meditation to receive God's will and the power to carry that out. The same idea. And on the bottom of the steps, he added a 12th step, thing that they had actually found already, the advantage of one alcoholic helping another. So he took the 6-step program of the Oxford groups, kind of expanded them into the 10-step plan of recovery. And on the top of those steps, he added the 2 conclusions of Silkworth, which dealt the allergen obsession, which make us powerless over alcohol, step 1. And the solution that came from Carl Jung, the power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. So our 12 steps are expanded program of the Oxford groups, coupled with the ideas of Dr. Silkworth and Dr. Carl Jung. And that's where we got the 12 steps.
Can you just imagine those other members when they saw the 12 steps the first time?
Yeah.
My God, Bill, what have you done?
That's right, amen.
Hell, we've had 6 steps now for 3 or 4 years, and all of a sudden you come up with 12. What the hell are you doing? Yeah. Well, in fact, one of them said, well, Jesus just had 12 apostles. Why do we need all those steps? You know how you'd feel if you left your group the other day and they had 12, and you go back next Monday night and they got 24. You'd raise hell with somebody about something to do. So he really didn't have troubles with this, but finally they accepted it.
Yeah.
Made a few changes, and the changes results in exactly what we've got today.
They didn't like it, though, did they?
No, they didn't like it.
They said it wouldn't work. We don't like it. Even when it was, yeah. When it come out, they said it won't work.
Now, let's go to page 60, and at the end of the 3 pertinent ideas, the next statement says, being convinced we were at step 3, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that, and just what do we do? Well, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. And we believe we ought to stop here and look at a few words and try to make sure maybe that we understand these words as Bill understood them. And I think there's 3 key words in step 3 that give us a lot of difficulty. Quite often I hear people say, well, I've been in AA 5 or 6 years and my life's still all screwed up, and I don't understand why, because I turned it over to God 3 years ago when I took step 3. No, we don't turn it over to God in step 3. We make a decision to turn it over to God in step 3. And just like with Bill and just like with Columbus and his decision did him no good until he was willing to take the action necessary to carry it out. The fact that we're making a decision in step three doesn't mean that we're going to turn it over. It just means we've decided to turn it over. A good example in my own personal life, a few years ago, Barbara and I decided that we wanted to go to Los Angeles, California and visit some of our relatives. Well, we didn't do anything to carry that decision out. And sure enough, we didn't get to Los Angeles, California that year either. The next year, about the same time of year, we made the same decision. And again, we didn't do anything to carry it out. And the second year in a row, we didn't get to California. The third year in a row, we made that decision. Only this time, it was a little different. This time, I took the car down and had it serviced. Barbara packed some clothes and a little food. And we got in our car and we drove from our home to Tulsa, Oklahoma. Then we drove to Oklahoma City. Then we drove to Amarillo, Texas. Then we drove to Albuquerque, New Mexico. Then we drove to Flagstaff, Arizona. Then we drove to Barstow, California. Then we drove to San Bernardino, California. And you know, by golly, one day we ended up in Los Angeles visiting with our relatives. Not because we made a decision to do so, but because we took the action necessary to carry it out. The decision is extremely important, but the decision doesn't do the job. The action is what does the job. Now, in order for us to turn our will and our life over to the care of God as we understand it, we're going to have to use the action steps 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, and 11. And then we'll get results just like Columbus did. We will have a spiritual awakening as the result of those steps. And too many of us are trying to go from step 3 to step 12 without taking the action in between the two. And therefore, they never carry out the decision. Now, what is it we're deciding to turn over? Well, first we're deciding to turn our will over to the care, and remember this step originally said, and direction of God as we understood Him. And what is our will? Well, our will is nothing more than our thinking apparatus. Our will is nothing more than our mind. Our will is nothing more than this thing up here in our head that tells us what to do and what not to do. A perfect example of tying the will and thinking together. Let's say some of us are beginning to approach the end of our lives, which some of us in here are getting fairly close. I hope we can put it off a little longer, but we're getting pretty close. And we've gathered up a few material things, and we become concerned with what's going to happen to them after we pass on. And normally, we will go down to an attorney, and we'll sit down with that attorney in their office. And we'll tell that attorney what we want done with those things. Now, I want this to go to my wife, this to my son, this to my daughter, so on and so forth. And the attorney will take my thinking as of that day, put it down in legal terms on a piece of paper. I'll sign it, maybe the attorney will sign it as a witness, and we'll put it in a safe. Now, 2 or 3 years later, sure enough, I kicked a bucket. And if my family's like all the rest of them, they're going to call the undertaker, and they're going to say, come get him. Get him ready, and let's get him out in that cemetery about as soon as we can. And a couple days later, they run me out to the cemetery, and they say a few words over the casket, and then they start dropping me down in the hole. Now, they don't even wait for me to get to the bottom of the hole. Just as soon as I start down in that hole, they all jump in the car, and they go to the attorney's office. And that attorney gets out that piece of paper and reads to them what my will was 2 or 3 years prior to that time sitting in that office. And we know that they call that thing, a piece of paper, a will. Will, thinking, mind are all synonymous. Now, what else am I going to try to turn over? Well, I'll make a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care and direction of God as I understand it. What is my life? Well, my life is nothing more than my actions. What I am today, right now, as of this moment, sitting behind this table, is the sum accumulative total of all the actions I've taken throughout my entire lifetime has made me what I am today. Now, all action is born in thought. All action is born in thought. Sometimes we act so fast, so automatically, that we think we do that without thinking, but we don't. I can't even reach out and pick up this cup of coffee unless my mind tells my body to do so. Now, since all action is born in thought, then it stands to reason that my life is going to be based upon how I think. If my thinking is good, chances are my actions are going to be good, and chances are my life's going to be pretty good. But if my thinking is lousy, then chances are my actions are going to be lousy, and life is going to become pretty lousy also. Now, when I got to this step three, I went to my sponsor and I said, I don't believe I can do step three. And he said, why? And I said, because if I turn my will and my life over to the care of God as I understand Him, I'm not sure what God would have me be. And He might want me to be a missionary. And He may want to send me to China. And I sure as hell don't want to go to China. And he just laughed. And he said, well, at least it wouldn't be in the hands of an idiot, would it? He said, let's look back in your lifetime, Charlie. He said, you've always been a selfish, self-centered, self-willed human being. He said, you've always done exactly what you wanted to do, whenever you wanted to do it, and to hell with the rest of them. He said, you've never paid any attention to God's will, to your parents' will, to your teacher's will, or anybody else's will. Now, he said, the end result of that is you almost destroyed your life. And he said, what's just as important and maybe even more so, you have almost destroyed the lives of all those around you who care for you. He said, now just think. He said, if God could direct your thinking, it might become better. And he said, if your thinking becomes better, then your actions are going to become better. And he said, if your actions become better, then your life's going to become better. And he said, just as important, the lives of all those around you who care for you might become better also. He said, Charlie, you're trying to find a way to live where you can be sober and have a little peace of mind, serenity, and happiness at the same time. And he said, left on self-will, you don't stand a chance. He said, you'll continue to think the way you've always thought. You'll continue to take the same actions you've always taken. And you will absolutely rob yourself of any possibility of peace of mind. And you will stay restless, irritable, discontented, filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And he said, under those conditions, sooner or later, you're going to start thinking about taking a drink. And the next thing you know, you'll think it's okay to drink and you'll end up drunk all over again. He got it to me in such a way that he made it very clear that if left on my own will, there's simply no way am I going to find the peace of mind and happiness necessary for good, long-term sobriety. And by the way, as far as we know, we're the only species on earth that's ever faced with this decision. As far as we know, all the other species on earth, they don't have self-will. They can't make choices. They don't make decisions. Everything that they do in their lives is done on God's time and on God's direction. As far as we know, we're the only species that He gave this thing called self-will to. And you'll notice these other species, very seldom do they get in trouble with self-will because they don't have self-will to operate on. We've never seen a tree hit a car yet. They just don't have those kind of troubles.
So. Yeah. You know, I approach this step with the same misunderstanding, misconception, and fear that everyone does when we hear it. You know, I was like Charlie. I was got real threatened when I found out turning my life over to God. I didn't know what God would do with my life. Not what I was doing with it. I never looked at that. My greatest fear, I didn't think God would make me a missionary. I didn't think I was good enough for a good missionary. But I always laugh about it. My greatest fear is I thought God would put me in the Salvation Army band. I just figured that's what I was going to end up at. You know. It's getting near the holiday times, and I always laugh. It's near holiday in there. When they out doing the Christmas, I always, you know, I always watch the Salvation Army band. I'm interested in that thing. I laugh every time I just think about it. And all these years, and 33 years, I've been watching the Salvation Army band, and I don't know why I had that fear. I haven't ever saw a black guy in the Salvation Army band. That ain't really our kind of music, I don't think. Well, we all approach this step with different fears and anxieties about what will my life be like. And instead of looking at what it is already, right? Not what we're going to be like, but what we're going to get away from. As Charlie said there, I don't know why we get so hung up on, I guess so misunderstanding of will. I was the same way too, because will is a very simple thing. There are, but as Charlie said, no other animals on the face of this earth, or even any other living plant, any other living thing has will. We humans are the only thing on earth that has the ability, has will, the ability to direct and decide, right? And the intelligence, so God gave us that, and He gave us the intelligence to be able to do that. And no other animal gets in trouble, right? No other plant gets in trouble. And we can look around the world, and if we look out the windows anywhere we look out today, we can see the things that out there, the material things and the things that we have created. There are but two forces that create in this world. There are some things that out there that were created by humans, and everything else out there was created by God. There are but two forces of directions, or two forces that can create, and that's man and God. As the story goes in the big, big book, they talk about the beginning when they created this in the big, big, big book. I don't know if any of y'all read that book. It's a pretty good book. Need some new stories in the back, but it's a pretty good book.
Some of those stories are outdated.
Yeah. Anyway, it talks about the guy who created this world and all the other things that were in it. In other words, seemingly like the animals were put here, the animals were created, and the plants were created, and all the things were in this world. God directed those things. He placed them in this world. So, and He said it was nice. I guess it was, because we weren't here yet, you know. They were here first. And then He decided He wanted something in His own image. I got off in that, talk about physical image, but I mean he wanted something in His own likeness, something else with will, something else with intelligence to direct. He could communicate with. So He created we humans, and He gave us intelligence, and He gave us will.
Now that doesn't mean the other species don't have intelligence. They just don't have enough to be considered as self-will.
That's right. So, you know, He placed them in a little garden here on earth, and nice place, quiet, called Serenity Park. And I had a meeting every night from it. And meeting every night, you know. And they were, since God directed that the other animals, and they were new at life, they kind of went along, Adam and Eve kind of went along with God's program and let God direct them. And it was all right. I mean, they followed God's directions and everything went great. And finally, the story talks about a little snake come along. You know, the snake come along and saw Eve one day and he said, "Honey, what are y'all doing?" And she said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Did you know you and Adam had self-will?" And she said, "No, what's that?" He said, "Child, look, you don't have to do what he says. I do, because he directs me. But you and Adam got self-will. Y'all can do what y'all want to do.
Eat that apple if you want to.
Yeah, you can do anything y'all want to." And Eve said, "You know, boy, I'm sure glad to hear that." She went and found Adam. Adam said, "We got self-will." Adam probably said, "What's that, child?" So she ran it down to Adam real good, you know, and Adam understood it. And Adam made a decision.
She said, "Adam, let's eat that apple."
That's right. And Adam made a decision. Now, it was a bad decision. But, you know, I don't know why we knock Adam about that. That was the first one he ever made. He didn't know what he was doing. Did he? And he made a decision to eat the apple. And when God saw that apple gone, he knew they had found out how to make decisions. He knew they had found out about self-will, and they had used it. And so he simply said, you know, "You're going to have to leave here." He said, I control this garden. I direct this garden. I care for everything that I direct. But if you're going to direct yourself and make decisions on self-will, you have to leave and go out and care for yourself. He said, "You have to leave this place." So they were told to leave. And as they left, you know, he said, "Well, before you leave, I want to make a deal with you. Set a covenant with you humans." He said, "You'll have to leave, but you can come back." He said, "You can come back and I'll direct your life and care for you just like I'll care for the other animals. Under one condition. If you come back, you'll have to give self-will back to me. You know what I mean? That's the deal we got, you know. Only we can make decisions." And the Oxford Group people used to say it, they simplified it so much. This is simply making a decision to give back to God what he so freely gave to us. And he said, "I will direct and care for your life just like the other animals. But only you can make that decision."
He also said, "I love you enough that I'll let you stay out there and destroy yourself if that's what you want to do." He said, "I'll never take self-will back. You will have to freely give it back to me." So we're still faced with that same decision today. Now, I don't know whether that story's right or not. Certainly fits the part of the book we're talking about, and it does make a little sense. We think Adam might have possibly been an alcoholic. When God saw that the apple was gone, he jumped on Adam.
Yeah.
And he said, "Adam, where's the apple?" And Adam said, "Well, we ate it." And God said, "You ate it? Why did you eat it?" And he spun around and he pointed at Eve and said, "She made me do it." And we've been telling them that ever since, too. for years, of course, like everybody else, were confused about this step three thing. We were confused about page 60, 61, and 62. Until one time, we got into the 12 and 12, and we read a little information on a couple of pages in the 12 and 12. And we want to share that with you. We don't want to go to the 12 and 12. We just want to talk about it a little bit. About 13 years after Bill finished the big book, the decision was made to write the 12 and 12. There's always been a lot of questions as to why he wrote the 12 and 12, and I don't really guess anybody will ever know for sure. But I think one reason he was willing to write it is he'd had so much trouble selling the traditions to the fellowship that he decided if he could put the traditions together in a book with the steps, that the traditions themselves might be more acceptable to the fellowship. I think that's one of the reasons he wrote it. But I think another reason he wrote it is 13 years later, Bill knew a lot more about this stuff than he did in 1939. You know, let's face it, in 37, 38, 39, Bill Wilson was not a spiritual giant. He'd only been sober 3 or 4 years. All of his training had been in economics, business, law, and etc. He was not a great student of human nature. He was not trained in those areas. Now, he knew something about human nature. You have to be a good salesman. But he certainly was not trained in those areas. He did the best he could in the big book. We believe today that God used Bill to write the words, and God put his ideas on paper through Bill. God really wrote the big book. But 13 years later, Bill knew a lot more about these things. He had worked with some of the best spiritual minds in the world, and he had learned a lot of stuff. He had worked with some of the best minds in the world regarding human nature. He had also worked with many alcoholics in that period of time. I think Bill felt that if he could take some of this new information that he had learned, give it to us in written form, then we could use that information to better work the steps according to the Big Book Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's a book that is meant to be in addition to, not to take the place of, the Big Book. You can't work the steps out of the 12 and 12. There's no directions in there on how to work them. I think that may be why many people love it, because they can get in it and dance around and philosophize and talk about it and never have to do anything, because it doesn't pin you down. The only directions on working the steps are in the Big Book. But there's some information in the 12 and 12. If we can see it and accept it and understand it, then it makes the working of the steps according to the Big Book so much easier and so much simpler. And one day in going through the 12 and 12, we found on the first couple of pages of step 4 in the 12 and 12, some information about what Bill referred to as the 3 basic instincts of life. Now, he mentions them in the Big Book just a little bit. In the example on step 4, he talks about these social instincts, security instincts and things, but he didn't explain it in the Big Book. I don't think he could explain it in the Big Book. But in the 12 and 12, he does. And he said, all human beings are born with these 3 basic instincts of life. He said they are absolutely necessary for survival of the human race. They are God-given. Therefore, they must be good. And he talked about the social instinct, the security instinct, and the sex instinct. And he said, under the social instinct, that all human beings are born with a desire to be liked, to be accepted, to be respected by other people. He said, all human beings are born with a desire to come together in groups with other human beings. And he said, if we didn't have that desire, if we cared nothing about each other, that we would go into a dog-eat-dog situation, complete anarchy would reign, and under those conditions, the human race would simply fail to survive. So this desire that you and I have to be liked and accepted and respected, this desire that we have to succeed and have other people look up to us, these things are all God-given. Therefore, they're not bad things. And under the term social instinct, he uses several words. He uses the word companionship. And companionship is nothing more than wanting to belong or to be accepted by other people. He uses the word prestige. Prestige is wanting to be recognized or accepted as the leader. And the world needs leaders. Somebody has to be a decision maker. I guess even back in the old caveman days, somebody had to say, John, get behind that tree with your club. Joe, get behind that bush over there with your spear. And Mary Jo and I'll run this sucker through here, and we'll all, you know, somebody got to do that. And most of us will take one of two directions. Either let me be a part of, or let me be the leader of. And in either case, it's going to be based upon what other people think of us. If they like us and accept us and respect us, then we can become those things that we want to be. He uses the term self-esteem. And self-esteem is nothing more than what we think of ourselves, high or low. If it seems as though other people like us and accept us, we feel pretty good about ourselves. If it seems as though they don't, or we think they don't, we feel pretty lousy toward ourselves. He uses the word pride. And I'm glad I got in the habit of going to the dictionary to look words up. I always thought pride was something you ought to have. You know, as a young boy growing up, all I ever wanted to do was to be a man who walked tall with pride and just a little bit sideways like John Wayne does, until I found out what pride is. And pride is defined in the dictionary as an excessive and unjustified opinion of oneself. We either think too highly of ourselves or we think too low of ourselves. In either case, it's really not true. Personal relationships is nothing more than our relations with other human beings. Ambitions are our plans for the future to gain acceptance and power and recognition. Now, if you want to be liked and accepted and respected by the world and the people in it, the first thing you have to do is decide, well, what is it they want from me? And society usually teaches that to us as we grow up. And it'll vary in different parts of the world. One part of the world is to have a good education. Another part of the world, it may be to have be a large landowner. Another part of the world, it may be to have a large family. It could be any number of things. As society teaches those things as we grow up, then we in turn set goals for ourselves. And we decide whatever it is that we need to become in order to get the acceptance and recognition that we want and we need. Now, if you're going to reach the goal, let's say it's for a good education, you're going to have to work at it. You can't just be a bum, sit on your duff, and do nothing, and have other people like you and accept you. By the same token, you're probably going to have to make some sacrifices. And there are some things that I would like to do as a human being that really are exciting. But if I do them and you catch me at it, you're not going to like me at all. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary to reach the goals, nor make the sacrifices necessary unless we got a reward for doing so. And the great reward is that great feeling that we get at the moment of successful completion of the goal. Bill said it in his story when he said, I had arrived. God, how many of us have done it? And we've set that goal, and we've worked our tails off literally for years. And the day we reach the goal, they pat us on the back and they say, ah, Joe, you're doing great. You're a fine fella. You're a good man. There is one of those feelings that come over us which is absolutely indescribably wonderful. But the only thing wrong with it seems to be just a temporary feeling. Hell, we no sooner reach the goal and we look around, we say, well, is this all there is to it? And we set another goal. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we sacrifice and we reach the new goal and we get the praise and the recognition and the power that comes with it, but it doesn't last long, and we set another goal. It seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire for more and more power, more and more prestige, more and more recognition, and are not giving it to it fast enough, and are not letting us have it the way we think they ought to. So what do we do about that? Well, we take shortcuts. We start lying a little bit. We start conning a little bit. We start manipulating a little bit. We start stepping on other people's toes and climbing on their backs. And the instant we do so, we create pain and suffering for others. They in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. It's a plane that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success, because under those conditions, the satisfaction of that social instinct is so great that it automatically throws us in collision with people, places, and things, and it robs us of peace of mind. The very thing necessary for our survival will also be the very thing that destroys us left on self-will. He talks about the security instinct. Now, I know in AA we try to live one day at a time. But I also noticed about everybody in this room has an insurance policy. And the purpose of that insurance policy is to protect ourselves in the future. Bill said that all human beings are born with a desire to be secure in the future. And he said if we were not concerned with that, if we're not worried about that, we wouldn't do the things necessary to survive in the future. And we wouldn't put away the food, the clothing, the shelter, the things necessary for survival. And next winter, we would just freeze to death. Next drought season, we would starve to death. So this desire that you and I have to be secure is a basic God-given thing necessary for our survival. Now, if you want to be secure in the future, once again, you're going to have to determine, well, what is it I need to be secure? And society teaches this to us as we grow up. And it'll vary in different parts of the world. One part of the world, you just need $4. Another part of the world, you need $4,000. Another part of the world, you need $4 million. Another part of the world, you need 192 coconuts. Whatever it is that they use to base your trade and bargain with. Now, based on what society teaches us, we set goals. Now, if you're going to reach the goal to be secure in the future, once again, you're going to have to work at it. You can't be a bum and just sit on your duff and be secure in the future. Once again, you're going to have to make some sacrifices. We can't blow it all today and have anything we want today and be secure tomorrow. And I don't think you and I would do the work necessary to be secure nor make the sacrifices necessary if we didn't get a reward for doing so. And once again, it's that great, great feeling at the moment of successful completion of the goal. My God, how many of us have done it? We've set the goal for the new shoes, for the new dress, for the new suit, for the new drapes, for the new couch, for the new house, for the new car, for the new piece of property, for the new business. And we've worked and we've worked and we've worked and we've sacrificed. And the day that sucker's paid off and nobody can touch it, my God, what a great feeling that is. Why, if it's on the house, we may call in the neighbors, we may have a party, and we may celebrate by burning the mortgage. It's such a great thing. But the only thing wrong with it, no sooner do you get it paid off, and you look around, well, his house is bigger than mine, and she's driving a Cadillac, and I'm still in a Chevrolet, and he's got a Brooks Brothers suit, and I bought mine at Kmart's, and that causes us to set another goal. And we work and we work and we strive and we strive and we sacrifice and we reach the new goal and it feels good, doesn't last long, set another goal. Seems to create within we human beings an insatiable desire to collect more and more and more and more of these things, and our emotional security is based upon our material security. And if we don't find those things materially that we want and emotionally, we become an absolute basket case. Oh, it's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. Because if we're not getting the material things fast enough, we do the same thing there we did in the social instinct. We start lying. We start cheating. We start conning, manipulating, stealing. And the instant we do, we hurt other human beings. And then they retaliate against us. The third basic instinct he talks about is sex. Now, it's so important, I need a drink of water first. He said all human beings are born with a desire for sex. May get turned off by bad happenings or bad teachings, but he said all human beings are born with a desire to have sex. Because if we didn't have sex, we would not reproduce ourselves. And if we don't reproduce ourselves, then sure enough, the human race is going to fail or survive. So this desire that you and I have to have the sex act is a basic God-given thing necessary for our survival. Now also, just like the other two, if you're going to successfully reproduce yourself through the sexual act, you're going to have to work at it. Hell, you can do more work in 3 minutes of sex, if you can last that long, than you'll do all day digging a ditch. Don't you older guys remember how it used to be when we got through with it? My God, you just fall over sideways, the sweat's just pouring off of you. You can hardly get your breath, you feel like you've died, gone to heaven, come back two or three times. And I don't think you and I would do that kind of work if we didn't get a reward for doing so. And the great reward we get is that great feeling, both physically and emotionally, at the moment of successful completion of the sex act. One of the greatest feelings a human being can have. But also, just like the other two, it seems to be just a temporary feeling. Hell, you no sooner get through with doing it than you get to thinking about doing it again. And it's such an exciting and such a pleasurable thing that the next thing you know, you find you get to thinking about doing it in other ways. And then you get to thinking about doing it in other positions. And then you get to thinking about doing it with other people. And it seems to create an insatiable desire within us to have more and more sex in different ways with different people. And the next thing you know, we're doing it at the wrong time with the wrong people. And the instant we do so, we end up hurting others. They in turn retaliate against us and create pain and suffering for us. Oh yeah, it's plain that a life run on self-will can hardly ever be a success. Because based on self-will, in order to fulfill these basic instincts, it creates such insatiable desires that no human being can resist overdoing in these areas. And any time we overdo in these areas, we create pain and suffering for others. And they retaliate and create pain and suffering for us. And even if they don't catch us, we're scared to death they're going to. And if God dwells within each of us, then guilt and remorse begins to eat us up. And we absolutely rob ourselves of any possibility of peace of mind. You'll notice coming out of those three basic instincts, a little circle up there called self. That's what creates self-will. That's what causes us to do these things that continually end hurting other people and institutions. Coming out of self-will, you'll notice another little circle called wrongs. And wrongs is another word we have to look at. Somewhere in AA we got the idea that the word wrongs meant a list of dirty, filthy, nasty things. But if you go to the dictionary and look that word up, you'll find several definitions of it. One definition is incorrect judgment of others. And just a little bit later on, we're going to find out that's exactly what our resentment is. Another definition of the word wrong is incorrect believing. And a little later on, we're going to find out that's what most of our fears are. Another definition of the word wrong is the harms and hurts that we do other people. And a little bit later on, we're going to look back and find out that that's why we're eaten up with guilt and remorse due to the harms that we've done to other people. You know, it's easy to spot a selfish, self-centered human being. Now remember, there's only two wills to operate on. A God-willed human being, and they are usually peaceful, happy, and free. A self-willed human being, and you can tell the difference between the two immediately. A self-willed human being is always madder than hell. Damn him and damn her and by God they'll show me I'm not going to treat me that way and blah-de-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah-blah. Selfish, self-centered human being is scared to death. Never have been able to depend upon God. Never have been able to depend upon other human beings. And if we're a practicing alcoholic and we're reaching the end of the road, we can't depend on ourselves anymore and we've got to be running absolutely scared to death. Selfish, self-centered human beings eaten up with guilt and remorse associated with the harms they've done to people in the past. Even if they didn't catch us, if God dwells within us, we know the difference between right and wrong, and guilt and remorse eats us up. A selfish, self-centered human being doesn't feel good. One who's angry all the time, one who's afraid all the time, one who's eaten up with guilt and remorse is very effectively blocked off from God's will. And God can't enter that mind. And what we're going to have to do as human beings, if we want God to direct our will, we're going to have to look at these things that are the outgrowths of self-will, and we're going to have to do something about their removal. And if we can get rid of that resentment, if we can get rid of that fear, if we can get rid of that guilt and remorse, then God can enter our mind and start to direct our thinking. But He won't take them away by Himself. We must do our part. And that's what step 3 and 4 is about. 3 is the decision, and 4 is the beginning of the action necessary to have these things removed that block us off from God. Joe?
As Charlie says, self-will, we were designed and we were created by God in this fashion. We were given these basic instincts to motivate us and to control and make us humans and set us apart from the other animals. So therefore, self-will is good. We would not have it if it wasn't good. God gave us this thing called self-will. And these are the things, this is the root of everything that we do. The motivation of everything that we do is based on the satisfaction of these instincts. I like to look at it sometimes and illustrate it sort of like this building, maybe. You know, we have this building, it would be like our lives. The body we live in, the physical plane, and all that stuff. You know, we got the walls and the ceiling and the floor and all the furniture, everything that's in here. But down in the heart of this building, we have some lights, some oil, and some water.
Some utilities.
Utilities. These are utilities in this building. Now, if the utilities weren't in the building would not be livable. Because that's the real power of the building. Also, you know, about the utilities, usually one of the utilities that destroys the building. It's very, very important, but they sure have to be controlled and watched. And this is what self is in our lives. Self is like the utilities in us. It's the power of our lives. It's the thing that motivates everything that we do. And it has to be controlled too. Because once it gets out of control, and what then the asset becomes our liability, it becomes a destructive force. And every human life, not just the alcoholic, Bill says this, it's a powerful statement. Every human being in the world, and that's a lot of them, every man, woman, and child in the world today, every problem that every human being has in the world
emotionally
comes from self. Self is the root of every problem. You know, one of those basic instincts gets out of control, and then we do things to hurt other people and we get in trouble. You know, you take every person that's in prison today, is there as a result of the same thing, satisfying one of his basic instincts. What did he steal? For security? Did he steal for companionship? Did he steal to build his self-esteem? One of those basic instincts had to be out of control, else he never would have stolen. So self is the root of all human problems. All of them are born there, and a problem is a result of a misdirected instinct. So really, we find that life is real simple. God gave us these. It's a very powerful force when we look at them. And when I really dawned on me what a powerful force this was, it really showed me the inability of me ever controlling something like that. And this self-will, if we can't control self-will, now remember now, there isn't but one other will in the universe that we know of to turn it over to. If we can't control self-will, the only other will involved is God's will, so we have to turn it over to God's will. And then God can direct our will, and we can have is the only chance we got to be happy. There's no other thing that we can do. We can't control it ourselves. We can't give it to the guy next door because he's got one he can't handle. I mean, nobody else wants it. Only God can correct what he made.
Now I begin to understand. Yeah. Page 60 and page 61. Yeah. The first requirement down at the bottom of 60, the first requirement is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Yeah. On that basis, we're almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show. As a kid growing up, I drew in my mind a little script that I was going to play. And I was going to become this, and I was going to do that, and I would do this. And then you would look at me and you'd see how great a fellow I really am. Also, I drew in my mind a little script for the part my wife would play when I got married. And she would do this, and she would do that, and she would do this, and she'd have a couple of kids, and people would look at her and they'd see how smart I was because I married her in the first place. Then I had a little script known in my head for my children to play. they were going to become this and they were going to become that, and people would look at them and say, what a great man Charlie really is. Now, the only problem that I had with that deal is I didn't know that they had a script already drawn in their head, and it didn't necessarily match mine. And when my wife didn't fit into the script that I had designed for us, instead of backing off and letting her be whatever she wanted to be, all I did was start exerting more pressure on her to bend around to my way of thinking. Same thing with my kids, same thing with my co-workers, same thing with everybody around me. I did not know I was doing that, nor did I know why I was doing that, until I saw these basic instincts of life. They're what causes us to do that kind of stuff. He said, each person is like the actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would mind, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he's more likely to have varied traits. Now, what usually happens? Well, the show doesn't come off very well, and he begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself more. He becomes, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he's sure that other people are more to blame. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he really not a self-seeker, even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim with a delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are things that he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not, even his best moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? Anybody besides me see themselves on that page? Every human being fits into that category to one degree or another, absolutely robbing ourselves of peace of mind. Page 62, first paragraph. Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles.
Root.
Driven by 100 forms of fear. Fear we're not going to have enough. Fear we're going to lose what we got. Fear that they're going to catch us. Fear, fear, fear. Self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows and they retaliate. Trying to fulfill the basic instincts of life, we step on the toes of other human beings and they retaliate. Sometimes they hurt us, seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we've made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. I'm going to read that again because it's so important. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Now, we don't think so. Mm-mm. But when we take step four, we're going to be able to see that.
No, it appeared to me when I got here, and maybe to you and most of us, I know it did to me, I can't know about you. When I got here, everybody was picking on me.
That's right.
The whole world was just waiting to get me and picking on me. That's the way it looked. But after the inventory process and I was able to get down to the truth about it, I found out that in every case, I had did something to satisfy one of my basic instincts and my desires. And satisfying my basic desires, I did something to hurt them, and then they retaliated. But it appeared that I had done nothing, that they were just picking on me. When I found out, That's just the way it happened.
So our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves. And the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run right, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. It doesn't say we ought to be. It says we must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. And there often seems no way of entirely getting rid of self without His aid. Many of us had moral and philosophical convictions galore, but we could not live up to them even though we would like to. Neither could we reduce our self-centeredness much by wishing or trying in our own power. We had to have God's help. I think one of the greatest mistakes in AA today is self-will trying to overcome self-will, trying to make ourselves be better. And we got to face the fact we can't do that. God made self-will. And only God has the power to overcome something He made. And only He has the power to overcome self-will. That's why we have to give it back to Him. Because if we continue to operate on self-will, we're continually in hot water. Now this is the how and the why of it. First of all, we had to quit playing God. You know, if this is a God-directed world, and I think it is, then those of us who have been self-directed, and those of us who not only were self-directed, but tried to direct everything and everybody around us, we've been trying to do God's work for Him. And we're not God. We've just been playing at being God. It didn't work. Next, we decided hereafter in this drama of life, God was going to be our director, not our suggester, our director. He is the principal, we are His agents. He is the Father, and we are His children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we pass to freedom. He is the director. Now I got a guy back home that he's always praying. And when he prays to God like a list of Santa Claus. He says, God, give me this, and God, give me that, and God, do this, and God, do that, and if you'll do this, I'll do that, and blah, 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 blah. I told him one day, I said, you know, in this other big book that Joe talks about once in a while, I said, there's a story in the very beginning of it, and it said God made all this stuff in 6 days, and then on the seventh day He rested. And I said, nowhere in that book does it ever say that He went back to work again. It looks to me like if there's going to be anything done, we're going to have to do it. He is the employer, and we are the employee. He doesn't have to do what we want Him to do. He doesn't have to bargain with us. Hell, He's got the stick. He is the boss. I finally realized that after about 20-some-odd years in AA.
Okay. You notice he also said here, most ideas are simple, and this concept, he's talking about step three, this concept, the idea of turning our will on like that, was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. And again, when he comes back, as he always does, he goes way out of the chapter, so when he comes back to the same picture he's painting. He started out in the first chapter talking about step willingness was the foundation. And then if you put in, become willing to change, the second step, believing, was the cornerstone. So on the foundation, we placed the cornerstone. We didn't even know we were building something, but we didn't know up to this point what we were building. Now we're at step three. After we finished step three, he says step three is the keystone of the arch through which we're going to pass through to freedom. So we're building an arch, like in a wall, and it's through this arch that we're going to pass through to freedom. And step three is the keystone. Now the keystone was the very stone in the top of the gate. All the other stones were cut to lean against the keystone. So the keystone was a supporting stone. That's step three. And we're building this arch through which we pass to freedom. And he also associates this arch with a personality. We're building a personality change. This arch is the gate that's through which we pass to freedom. So we have put three stones. Later on, when we finish step five, we're going to come back and he's going to use this again and put in some more stones. So he's given us a picture of progress as we build this arch. All right, we build this personality change through which we pass to freedom from alcohol.
Now, at the top of page 63, we're going to see what the results will be in our lives if we take step three. by looking at the result that happened in their lives.
That's right.
When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things followed. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, if you notice employers capitalized there, that's God. Yeah. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, as we became conscious of his presence, we began to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. We have become entirely different people. Not in our bodies, but in our minds. We've gone from restless, irritable, discontented to one who has a little peace of mind and serenity. The changes take place as we go through the steps. We don't have to wait till step 12 to get something out of them. Every step is a positive happening. We were now at step 3. Now let's see how we take step 3.
Many of us said to our Maker as we understood him, God, offer myself to thee to build with me and to do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will. Take away my difficulties, that victory over them may bear witness to those I would help of thy power, thy love, and thy way of life. May I do thy will always. Our step 3 prayer. From here on out, beginning with step 3, we are going to have some prayer in every step, every one of the action steps. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could last abandon ourselves utterly to him. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, our spiritual advisor. And at the time the book was written, they didn't have a sponsorship. They worked with each other. And most of the time, step 3 was taken with, in a union with another person. You know, they would go out and take you upstairs, really. And when they was in Dr. Bob's house, they would carry the guys upstairs. And they would all get down on their knees with two or three of them, and this guy would make his surrender. And when he got through, they would vote and decide if he did it good enough. If he didn't do it good enough, he might go back and have to do it again. But they knew that he did it, and they were involved with him. This may be the best way to still to do this.
But it's better to meet God alone than the one who might misunderstand. Yeah. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. There was only a beginning. Though if honestly and humbly made an effect, sometimes a very great one was felt at once. Once in a while, somebody will have a spiritual experience right here at the end of step 3. And they'll just change almost in a blinding flash of light, just like Bill did. Most of us, though, it's only the beginning. And we'll change as we progress through the rest of the steps. I like to look at the statement in the second paragraph when it says, we thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to him. And I think the word utterly means completely, all the way, wholeheartedly, the complete ball of wax. God's not interested in part. I think he's interested in all of us. Now, the mistake I made when I first took step 3, I remember getting on my knees and saying, God, I offer myself to build with me and do with me as thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do thy will, so on, so on, so forth. And as I finished it up, I said, now this applies to my alcohol. Don't fool with my sex life. Stay out of my money. I can handle that quite well, thank you. And today I realize the fallacy in that kind of thinking is that God don't even drink. He doesn't want the alcohol. He wants me. He wants the whole ball of wax. And just think, if God could direct my thinking in all areas, not just alcohol, but in sex, in money, in power, in prestige, maybe my thinking would become better in all areas. And maybe my life could become better in all areas. I think I'm beginning to understand what they said back in How It Works when they said some of us tried to hold on to our old ideas. And the result was nil until we let go absolutely. I think I'm beginning to understand when it said half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked His protection and care with complete abandon, not partial abandon, complete abandon. I think that's what we need to recognize in step three. We're making a decision to let God be the director of our entire thinking apparatus. Therefore, He would then be directing our entire lives, and hopefully it gets better in all areas. The other thing I think so important here is we found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with another person. We human beings are tridimensional creatures. We are designed to live with God, ourselves, and other human beings. And it's long been known that prayer, taken in connection and in the company of other human beings, seems to have a much deeper and a much longer lasting effect. Because there we're trying to fit ourselves back together as human beings with God and with other human beings. I know the people I sponsor, I insist they take step three with me for two reasons. Number one, if they take step three with me, I know they've taken it. That's the only way I know for sure. But the real reason is every time we take it together, it has a deeper meaning for me. And it means more, and it lasts longer in my life too. I think it's a very good idea. You know, we alcoholics are funny people. You know, we let our family see us every morning on our knees in the bathroom, hugging the porcelain bowl, puking our guts up. We come to AA and we're trying to do something about our lives, and we're ashamed to let them see us on our knees praying to God. Aren't we funny people? Thank you all for being here. We'll see you later on. Okay. Everybody have a good dinner?
Yeah.
Everybody all enthused and hot to trot and ready to start on step four?
I know.
We have we've done a lot of work up to this time now, mentally. We've been able, through the doctor's opinion and Bill's story, to basically see what our problem is. The physical allergy and the obsession of the mind, which leads to the powerless condition. We've been able to see through chapter 2, 3, and 4, the need for the power greater than we are. What's going to happen to us if we don't find that power? The fact that we have two powers, the power of the fellowship and the power of the vital spiritual experience. We've been able to change some of our ideas and some of our attitudes toward that power through chapter 4, the chapter 2, we agnostics. We've been able in chapter 5 up to this point to be able to make our decision. And what we're really deciding is between steps 1 and 2. Do we want to stay powerless and continue to drink until we die from alcoholism? Or do we want to accept spiritual help? And if we make the decision to go after the spiritual help, then it's going to result eventually in the turning over of our will and our life to the care and direction of God as we understand Him. In other words, trying to give back to God what was freely given to us, self-will. So we've made our decision, and now let's see what we do to carry out that decision. At the bottom of page 63.
My name is Joe, and I'm a real alcoholic. Again, in step 4, at the last bottom of the page. Next, we launched on a course of vigorous action. The first step, which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision,
step 3,
was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless followed at once by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Now he says, now step three is a very crucial step. But we notice is it has little permanent effect. Now it's just the beginning. It's the first step in the recovery process. Little permanent effect. Unless it followed at once, right away. You know, we hear a lot of people ask us, when should you take step three? When should you, after you take step three, how long should you wait to step four? We can hear all kind of questions, you know, and answers. People say a year, and one, they say one step a month. I usually hear all these crazy things. Heard one guy say, a guy was a professional in the field. I was so shocked. He was telling people to wait 2 years before they take an inventory. And we asked him how many people had he killed with that statement. God. You know, four always has followed three. I mean, but the best time to take step four is right after step three. Step three probably, this technique itself, probably removes just enough self to allow us to have a look at ourselves. So we take it at once.
If we don't get on with it.
Yeah.
Chances are self-will is going to come right back and say, well, we don't need to do this. Mm-hmm. Or it may say, we don't dare do this.
Okay.
And we continue to procrastinate. We stay restless, irritable, and discontented, filled with shame, fear, guilt, and remorse. And eventually the day comes when the mind begins to think about a way to feel better and begins to think about taking a drink. And we end up drunk all over again. So I don't really know how long I could go under those conditions without taking a drink. And frankly, I'm really not interested in finding out. So if we know that we need to take step four immediately after three, if we know that procrastination is going to kill us, then why would we even want to procrastinate at this stage of the game? And I think we probably do that for two or three reasons. I think one of the reasons we tend to procrastinate at this stage of the game is some of the older members love to play king off of the mountain with this step and tell the newcomer how tough it is. You just wait till you get to step four. Blah, be blah, be blah, blah, blah. And we just literally scare them to death. I think sometimes we older members are one of the causes for the procrastination. I think another reason we tend to procrastinate is we read over in step five something about sharing all your life story with another human being. And we thought, oh hell, I don't want to do that. So therefore, if we don't do that, then we won't have to let another human being see all those bad things about us. And we tend to procrastinate. I think probably the main reason is, for years we didn't understand how to do step four, the way the big book says to do it. So in our attempt to do something, we picked up that statement from step five that said all your life story. And we said, oh, that must be what they want us to do in step four. So we began to write our life story. Now, mine probably wasn't too important to other people. It must have been to me. There was about 92 pages in it. And I took it to another human being. He read it, said, not too pretty, is it? And he threw it in a waste paper basket. He said, you'll never have to be that way again.